Let's dive in, shall we? Before I forget, I'm going to push it twice. I did. So Hillary, unfortunately, with her some of the medical conditions she's rolling through, she's decided to take an off-ramp of residency. So just be mindful and praying for her. I don't think that was what she wanted. I think it was probably what was necessary. So she and Shay met yesterday and talked through it, but I think she's just having a rough go. So I don't know a ton of the details. Some of you probably know a ton more than I do, but let's just be mindful to pray for her. With that, in her absence, Adolph has agreed to step up and take Friday morning setup responsibility, so he'll be here with the key. But we have now lost our second tax collector, so we need somebody else that can step in and do that. So if there is one of you that, oh, yes, we will get lots of money. Thank you, Janelle. Absolutely. So, yes. Yes, you will. Yes, you will. She'll have a doll in her room with pins in it. I don't know where that came from. I can see you just poking, pay my money. So, we'll see. Perfect. Thank you. So, at this point forward, if you'll handle those responsibilities, that would be great. So, if you're late, meet with Janelle. That'd be awesome. So, cool. Perfect. Perfect. Yes. Yes. It's good. Yeah, you know what? Hey, you're the treasure. You know what? You handle it however you want. So Proverbs, let's start there this morning as always. 24:27. This actually ties into what we were talking about yesterday. I was actually trying to find this verse and failed miserably yesterday as my wife was talking. The question was asked yesterday, how do you know when you're prepared for marriage? I think we're talking through the singleness side of things a little bit. And she was running with an idea, and oddly enough, I was like, oh, you should finish that. And she was like, oh, I'm trying to finish that, and I can't remember where it is. Anyway, she talked about the idea of kind of emotionally knowing when you're ready and living with roommates and making sure that, you know, you're in community and those sorts of things. The other part that I'd continue on, specifically with guys, is 24:27. As we've talked about a little bit, at least Shay has with you guys, about extended adolescence and how do you know that you're at the place of just simple physical readiness, financial readiness. 24:27 is a great, I think, reminder to us as dudes as to what maybe we need to think through before we transition into that stage. Somebody read that.
Prepare your outside work. Make it fit for yourself in the field, and afterward build your house.
All right, so mine says prepare your work outside and make it ready for yourself in the field. In context in Israel, what does that mean to prepare your work outside? What was your outside work? You're farming, right? Okay, so what does that mean? What is farming ultimately for a farmer? It's their food and it's their income, right? It's their livelihood. This is how they're going to live day to day. So prior to building your house, or in context, maybe your home, wife, kids, and the things that come with a home, what are we to do first? Yeah, you need to be able to provide. Like, you need to be able to have a plan put together of at least an idea of, man, how am I going to manage and steward and be responsible for a home and all the things that come with it? Not just physically a house, but, man, how am I going to take care of my wife? How do we have a plan put together, right? And that's something I think we all need to think about in terms of, at least fellas, how we're going to do that, right? When I sat down with my father-in-law to be and asked for my wife's hand in marriage, he wanted to know this, right? And he wasn't looking for, hey, are you going to make my wife millions of dollars? He knew the career path that I had chosen with being a pastor, and right? So he wasn't looking for a number. So guys, as you're thinking through that, this isn't about how much money, but it's about, is that a desire of yours? Can you do that? Are you willing to work hard and provide for this gal and to give her a sense of security? One of the biggest needs of a woman is emotional security, physical security, to know that, man, if it all goes awry, I got a man that's willing to go flip burgers at McDonald's if that's necessary. He'll go dig holes and work construction if that's what's necessary, even if he's a banker or a whatever, but in between life, you know, he's willing to do that. I've shared with you guys in here before the example that my dad was with this. He was in the oil industry in Texas in the 80s, and the oil industry went in the toilet, and my dad had to take some weird, odd jobs for seasons where he made like a third of what he was making in his normal day-to-day careers, but he was just willing to work. He was willing to do whatever was necessary to take care of the family. And my mom worked in different seasons. That's not to say that a gal can or shouldn't, but there needs to be a plan as to how we're going to manage a household and allow that to kind of formulate, okay? Especially in this time where on a really bad day, we as fellas get the rap of wanting to extend adolescence, hang out in mom's basement, play Xbox until we're 30, mooch off the family. Okay, again, there's nothing wrong with living at home, but you heard Rick and Shavo talk about it yesterday, that idea of breaking dependence with mom and dad. There has to be that idea. So as you guys are moving down that road of a relationship with a gal, that just needs to be an indicator. Okay, and it's not about the amount of money. It's about the heart behind it and the ability to say, yes, I'm willing to do these things and work hard. And if my wife wants to stay at home for a season and we want to raise kids and we want to make those decisions, we've got the ability to do that. And if not, then we can make those decisions on our own as well. Okay, so fellas, just something to put in your hat, okay? Gals are going to need security. And one of those things, more than anything that shows that, is the ability for us to say we're willing to work regardless of the beauty of the opportunity or how great the money is or if that's something we like or not. We need to be willing to do that, okay? Thoughts on that? Ladies, is that an important concept for you? I'm speaking that from a guy's point of view, but for those of you that are single and married. Okay? Yes, Janelle says yes. Okay? Something to think about, all right?
And so, like you said, it's not necessarily about the amount of money, just knowing that there's going to be security there in the willingness to work. Okay. Just being a hard worker, you know, like your dad, for example. I've had the opposite. You know, dad not willing to work.
Peggy, what hypothetically, what happens to a gal when she watches a husband that's not willing to do that? What happens in your heart towards him?
Bitterness, anger.
What do you begin to lose for him?
Respect.
The number one need for a guy is what?
Respect.
It's not sex, okay? Though that's up on the list, okay, as you guys will learn about that. Respect is number one. And that's the first thing that women begin to lose if a guy isn't willing to say, you know what, that's not beneath me. I'm willing to do that. So I still fear as to why God taught me how to paint. 4 years in college, I learned how to paint in sheetrock. I painted apartments, like the bottom of the barrel painting, right? And painters are the worst. Most of them are either drunk and or, yeah, on a good day, they're drunk. On a bad day, they're more than drunk, right? But that's who I worked with. I'm like, God, why did you give me this skill set? I'm like, ugh. You know, I hope I don't have to put it to use all the time, but boy, there's been seasons where I'm glad I knew how to paint because it paid bills in tough seasons. And that's fine. So it's not my favorite, but boy, if I have to, I suppose I will. So I hope I will. So, okay? So, guys, just remember that. That's a huge need for a gal, and it speaks volumes. It creates an anchor in her soul that is so important for marriage. All right? Okay. Joshua, shall we? All right. Let me pray for us, and then we will dive into some more of this. Well, Lord, thanks for this morning. I'm mindful, God, of Hillary, who's gone, and Lord, what ailment she's dealing with, I don't know, but you do. So, Lord, I pray for her, and just pray that you bring healing to her. Lord, we know that you are able, you are good, you are fully capable, and you know what's going on with her, and we know that you're deeply concerned as well. So, Father, we pray that if it be your will, that you would heal her, that you would restore her to full health so she can live a normal interactive life and do the things that she feels like you have called her to do. Father, and if that's not your will and that you have put in her path some difficulties to push her and to stretch her and to mold her into the woman of God that you're desiring her to be, then I pray that she would respond in obedience, that she would trust you and cling to you in those moments. And regardless, Father, of what happens, that you would continue to be her king. So, Lord, we just are mindful of her as our sister in Christ, that you would take care of her needs in this moment. Lord, wherever she's at and whatever she's rolling with, Father, just be with her. And God, for the rest of us that are here, I pray that our minds and our hearts would continue to be focused as Christmas is coming and we're getting a break here in a couple weeks or for a couple weeks. Lord, would you continue to make us sharp, help us to study well, help us to see your word For all that it is, would we continue to bow our knee to you, our King, Lord, on this morning as we talked yesterday. I'm so grateful for your nature and your character, that you are a good and loving God, that you take care of us. And Lord, there's so many times that we just don't frankly understand who you are and how you do and why that you do the things that you do, Father, but we can trust you because of your character and your goodness. So Lord, we lean on you today, and we thank you for this time. In Christ's name, amen. All right. So we are boogieing, by the way. I looked at the chart yesterday. We're like a month ahead. So this has never happened in the history of residency. I'm a little bit nervous because once we get to the end, I don't know what else to teach. So, yeah. So we'll see. But we're like in January right now. So this is a wonderful feeling. So I'm mocking everyone else in our meetings weekly. So we'll see. I'm not quite sure how this happened, but it did. So you guys are pushing it, which is good. So we are in Joshua now. We finished the Pentateuch last week, the Torah, the first five books of Moses. Now we're moving into Joshua, and we're going to see this land that God has been promising his nation now for years and years and years, his people. We're going to see the people go into the land, okay? The theme of the book of Joshua is simply this, success, okay? You're going to see them be obedient for the most part and do what God has asked them to do. So Joshua's about success. The next book that we're going to read after Joshua is Judges. What would you guess is the theme of Judges? If Joshua is about success, Judges is about failure. Okay, so there you go. That's what's coming, right? So Joshua breaks down pretty easily as well. Okay, theme is success. 1 through 5 is really preparation to conquer the land, and that's what we're going to look at today. We're going to see God's instructions for Israel as they go in and what they're to do. And gang, it's Jack. It makes zero military sense. The strategy that God has is frankly dumb. It just doesn't make sense if you're a strategist and trying to figure out how to do it. However, if the sovereign God of the universe is your king and he's telling you how to do it and he's in control like he is, and we're called to trust him and not fight the battles per se, but to obey, then it makes complete sense. But boy, is God going to put these people in a position of faith and trust and say, hey, this is crazy, but this is what I'm asking you to do. Okay, so we'll see that this morning. 1 through 5 is preparation to conquer. 6 then through 12 is the actual conquest, the battles themselves. And we're going to see how God orchestrates this. And this side of things actually is brilliant. The way God has them conquer the land, I am told at West Point and other military academies, they still study how God had Israel go into the land and conquer it. The strategy is brilliant, and we'll see why it's brilliant partly this morning and then hopefully on Friday. 13 then through 22, half of the book of Joshua is about dividing the land. That's it. Hey, Reuben, come here. Here's your people. Here's the land you get. Here are the borders. That's a chapter. So we go from 13 all the way to 22 just on the dividing of the land of the 12 tribes. So it's insane that half of the book is involved with that, okay? And then 23 and 24 are literally kind of Joshua's parting words. He's going to say his last hurrah, he's going to die, and he's going to hand the baton over to some elders that he had trained. We'll see how that goes and how well he had brought up the next generation before him, okay? So that's the book of Joshua. 1 through 5, preparation to conquer. 6 through 12, the conquest itself. 13 through 22, dividing of the land. And 23 and 24, the swan song, the last words of Joshua. That's the book. Okay, and again, the theme of it is success. All right, so we have now had a major, major leadership transition, right? We've gone from Moses to Joshua the last 40 years. Moses, the guy that stands face to face with God and interacts with him, is now handing the baton to Joshua. So that's a concern for the people. How are they going to respond? How is God going to respond? The promises that he gave way back to Abraham, are those going to continue now with Joshua? We're going to see these battles, by the way, that they're going to fight. 31 battles Joshua will fight. Their record is 31-0, and they're going to have one do-over, one oops, and we'll see that this morning as well. So 31-0 with one place that God calls them to go conquer, and they don't do it quite right, if you will, and we'll see kind of the theme behind that. So lots to figure out, lots to discover here as we roll through. So chapter 1, verse 1, let's pick up there, and let's see how this beginning of the preparation for Joshua and his people are now going. 1:1.
After the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord, it came to pass that the Lord spoke to Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' assistant, saying, "Moses, my servant, is dead. Now therefore, arise, go over this Jordan, you and all the people to the land which I am giving you to, you're giving to them, the children of Israel. Every place that the sole of your foot will tread upon, I have given to you.
All right, so what are you seeing here that's continuing? Just as I spoke to Moses, sorry, Will. What are you seeing that's continuing? If you're an Israelite or if you're Joshua, what are you grateful for that God is still doing regardless of the death of Moses? The land is still there, right? And it's still promised. And just because Moses is dead doesn't mean that you're not getting the land. Okay, the bigger picture is obviously the land is God's land. So he's gonna do with it what he pleases. What else? What happens when your leader dies? Does it all go awry? No, Moses had appointed Joshua, and God says, great, that's your man, that's my man. That's fantastic. We saw this with Abraham, with Isaac, with Jacob. That promise continues, that lineage continues, and that baton is now being handed off, and the people now are going to have to choose, are they going to respond to Joshua? Are they going to heed his voice like they did Moses? I mean, seriously, how would you like to step in those leadership shoes, to come after Moses and begin to lead now 1 million to 3-ish million people through the promised land and hope that they respect you and listen to you and don't have a coup? I mean, it's a little bit crazy, and I don't think any of us would want that type of responsibility, okay? Keep going. Verse 4, the wilderness from Lebanon as far as the great river to the river Euphrates, the land of the Hittites as far as the great sea. So God is painting the picture of the land. This is the same promise way back in Genesis 15 to Abraham. This is the land that I've been talking about for hundreds and hundreds of years that you will now inherit. Notice what else continues here in verse 5. We'll pick up there.
No man shall be able to stand before you all the days of your life. As I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will not leave nor forsake you.
Okay, what is that?
Promise.
The promise, right? The protection of God, the presence of God. I will be with you. No one will be able to stand against you. And again, what is the key to victory? What do we talk about? One word, obedience. If you will obey me. And he's going to specifically say to Joshua, if you will walk with me as a leader and obey me, tuck this book of the law like in your heart, tuck it away, listen and obey, I will be with you. No one will stand against you. Okay. Verse 6, we've seen this repeated now a couple times in Deuteronomy 30. It's mentioned here yet again. We're going to see it mentioned a couple times in chapter 1. Watch what God now says to Joshua. Verse 7, only be very strong and courageous. Verse 9, have I not commanded you, be strong and courageous? Why is God telling Joshua to be strong and courageous?
Preparation.
What is the obvious thing? I mean, think about that. Why does someone tell you, hey, don't fear? Because you're fearful. You're afraid. What condition is Joshua in where God would need to tell him this, like, I think it's like 6 times. Is it okay to be scared to death as a leader? Yes, that's where Joshua's at. Now, is he going to be obedient? Yes, he's going to walk with God, but is he like, I got all this figured out, no problem, I'm not scared? The difference gang between leaders that do great things and leaders that cower down to fear is not that one feels fear and one doesn't. Joshua's going to feel fear, and God has to tell him, hey, relax, be strong, be courageous, I've got this. I am with you. And the ultimate difference is Joshua is willing to walk through that fear and see obedience as the greater goal. And say, I will obey God because I trust God and I know his nature and his character. So even though I am afraid, I'll push forward. Other leaders, lesser leaders or what have you, or the leaders that don't ultimately see maybe God's end result, cower down to fear. And it ends up winning the day. And their fear overwhelms their obedience, overwhelms their desire to walk with God. And that's ultimately what happens. So even though Joshua is afraid, which I love. Boy, if you think about the ventures and things that God's going to call you to do, there's going to be fear at some point in your life, right? You're going to get chased by police, maybe. Who knows? Okay, so Joshua is reminded several times. Okay, in verse 8, boy, here is the key to it all. This is... Boy, if there's a theme of the book of Joshua, this is a great one.
This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night, and you have observed, and that you may observe to be according to all that is written in it. For then you will make your way prosperous, and you will have good success.
And it's a great formula is a bad word, but you see the order of operations. here's the book of the law, which, by the way, had already been written. Joshua would have had with them the Torah, the book of the law. Here's the book of the law. Be careful to meditate on it as a leader, day and night, in the law of God. And once you do that, then I will make your way prosperous, and then you will have success. David talks about tucking the law of God in his heart, right? He's hidden the word of God in his heart so that he may not sin against God. And that's exactly what Joshua is told to do by God. Live the word, know the word, read the word, right? And in that, I will give you victory. I will give you success, but there is an order. I want obedience first, God says, okay? And again, do not tremble or be dismayed, all right? Now, verse 10, God has given him kind of general instructions. I want you to watch a leadership characteristic you're going to see in Joshua immediately. This is fantastic. God has given him the idea. You're going to go into the land, be obedient. 10 and following, the Lord commanded the officer, I'm sorry, Joshua commanded the officers of the people, saying, pass through the midst of the camp and command the people to and say, prepare provisions for yourselves, for within 3 days you are to cross the Jordan to go and possess the land which the Lord your God is giving you to possess it. Now, where did God tell him to do that? Hey, go in the midst of the people, communicate, and let's not do it tomorrow, but let's wait 3 days, Joshua. Let's wait 3 days, and then we'll go in. Where does God tell him that? He doesn't. Okay, so where does Joshua come up with this? He's a leader. He's like, you know what? I think we need 3 days. Was 3 days the right number? Could they have done it in 2? Yeah. Could they have done it in 4? Yeah. Were there many right ways to do this, if you will? Yes, in that sense. But Joshua says, you know what? I need to bring clarity to the people. One of the best things a leader can do in the midst of chaos and confusion is to bring clarity. We're going in 3 days. Does everybody understand that? Get provisions. Pack your backpack. Get your Samsonite ready, because in 3 days, we're all leaving. Does everybody understand that? That's what Joshua's doing. Okay, there's not necessarily a right or a wrong here, but as a leader, he's being clear. And that's one of the greatest gifts a leader can give to his or her people, is to speak with clarity and say, this is what we're all doing. Is everyone on the same page? This is how we're going to move forward. So Joshua's not given the plan by God. He's given the big picture, 30,000-foot view. But how they execute that plan to some degree is up to Joshua, the leader. Okay, so again, why he needs to be strong and courageous. Verse 12 now, watch this.
And the Reubenites and Gadites and half the tribe of Manasseh.
Who are they? Reuben, Gad, and the half tribe of Manasseh?
The one
that stayed on the other side, right? Joshua's now going to go to them and say, hey, oh, by the way, keep going, Will.
Remember the word which Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded you, saying, the Lord your God is giving you rest and giving you this land. Your wives and your little ones and your livestock shall remain in the land which Moses gave you on this side of the Jordan. But you shall pass before your brother in arm, all your mighty men of valor, and help them.
All right, so what is he reminding them of? Hey, y'all promised Moses something, and I'm cashing in that promise. You didn't promise it to me. You promised to Moses. And now I'm coming to you saying, you're going to come fight. Okay, you built your homes. You built your sheepfolds. You got like 40,000 fighting men. I expect you guys to come. Now, how are they to respond to Joshua? Did they make that promise to him? No. And the guy that they made the promise to is conveniently dead. So how are these guys going to respond now to Joshua's leadership? Verse 17. Verse 16.
So they answered Joshua, saying, all that you commanded us, us we will do, and wherever you send us, we will go. Just as we heeded Moses in the things and all things, so we will heed you.
How about that? How do these guys respond to Joshua? They do it. They're in, right? What does that tell you about how Joshua is received as a leader?
Respected.
Yeah, he's respected. They're like, okay, man, we made that promise to Moses. We're in. This is a hard leadership transition, and Joshua's trying to step in, and he's leading very differently. He's going to take these people into battle, right? They're not doing what they've been doing for the last 40 years, and he's got to have these people on his side. So he's wise about how he's going about this, making sure that he has earned the loyalty and the respect of the people that are ultimately going to go do battle for him and the rest of the tribes of Israel. And they respond, just as God said, before God to Moses, man, we're going to obey you. So we're good. And anyone who rebels against your command, verse 18, and does not obey, and all that you command him shall be put to death, only be strong and courageous. So don't be excommunicated from us, Joshua reminds them. And they're in. They're all the way in. Okay? So this is the first of now five chapters of prep. Verse 2 now, or chapter 2 rather, we're going to see Joshua's strategies to how he's going to go into the land. Read this, 2 verse 1. Shatim, I'll save you, you're welcome.
Go view the land, especially Jericho. And they went and came into the house of a prostitute whose name was Rahab and lodged there.
Okay, so why would Joshua send spies into the land?
It's been 4 years.
It's been 4 years, okay. Have they done that before? Yeah, how'd that go? Not so good. And who was a part of that original entourage? Joshua, right? How many did they send? 12. How many does he send this time? Let's just send 2. Like last time we got a really bad report. The 2 were good. Let's just send 2. So again, is there a right and wrong way to do this? Sure. Does God tell him to go send spies? Not necessarily. God says, you know, go attack the land and he's going to give him ideas. But yet God's going to, or Joshua's going to take some latitude as a leader and say, this is how we're going to do it. So he wants to know. He wants it spied out. He wants to know what he's up against. It's a smart plan. Okay. And he runs into a gal in verse 1. Named Rahab the harlot. He doesn't, but the spies that he sends into the land now are interacting with this gal who is lodged there, okay? A Canaanite harlot, okay? It was told, verse 2, by the king of Jericho, saying, behold, men have come here. They found out that there are spies in the land. The king of Jericho, in verse 3, sends word to Rahab, says, bring out the men who have come to you. So they are immediately found out, okay? Jericho is not a large town. None of the towns and that they're going to go destroy. I mean, get out of your heads, like, tens of thousands of people. It's hundreds of people, you know, 700, 800. Jericho would have been bigger than maybe some of the other towns around based on its fortifications, but it's not, they're not attacking Clovis, right? We're not talking about hundreds of thousands of people. So it's quickly found out that there are strangers in their hometown, and Rahab the harlot is called to account. And in verse 4, this is her story. Okay, so we find out what she really did in verse 6. She brought them into the roof of the house, hidden them underneath the stalks of flax, which she had laid in order to have basically a roof. So what do you call what she just did to the king of Jericho? A lie, right? She bold-faced lies to him, okay? Yeah, they came here, and then they left. They're not here anymore. I don't know where they were from, so they're gone, okay? But she had stuck them under her roof, okay? In Israel, the way you build roofs is you take, like, dried sheaves of grain or what have you, flax or whatever, and you would lay it on the layer of roof with mud and pitch or whatever, and it was literally like this giant, like, Bear Grylls, like, outside, right? That's what you think when you're camping in the wilderness, that type of deal. So she literally shoved them underneath the stalks of wheat or whatever she used in the roof. So it's nasty, but they're kind of hiding underneath there. So they look, and of course they don't see him there. It's a great hiding spot. She brought them to the roof. She hides them there. Verse 7, now the men who came in to pursue them went out on the Jordan road to the fords, now down to the Jordan, which is where they had come from, and pursued them. Okay, so they leave. So her plan works. Now, it's one of the odd texts in our Bible where the Bible describes lying. Now, you can do with it theologically what you please. I don't know that it's encouraging this, but boy, this is certainly a plan that we're going to see is very favorable. It works very well. Verse 8, now she's going to speak to the men. Watch this. This is fascinating to listen to her response as she speaks on behalf of all the people of her town.
Before the men lay down, she came up to them on the roof and said to the men, I know that the Lord has given you the land, and that the fear of you has fallen upon us, and that all the inhabitants of the land melts away before you.
How about that? So how is everyone in the land, how do they view Israel coming in? Number one, whose land is this?
It's theirs.
It's theirs. We know that God has given you the land. It's yours. Okay? And what else do you notice is their position before them? The terror of you has fallen on us. How do they view the Israelites? They're freaking out. They're terrified of them coming in, right? They've got fortified cities, they have walls, they have gates, and then we have all these people who've been walking around the desert for 40 years with no military equipment per se. They're not prepared for battle. and they're going to go in, and it should be maybe juxtaposed. Now, Israel certainly has the numbers, but they do not have the military strategy. They don't have the weapons. They don't have the know-how, and these people are wigging out before them, and here is why. Look at 10 and 11. Okay, verse 10. How long ago did the Lord dry up the water of the Red Sea? 40 years. They've been thinking about that. Like, we heard about what your God did coming out of Egypt. It was 40 years ago. And the other bookend, what you did to the Amorite kings Sihon and Og. Who were those dudes? The giants, right? The giant kings that Israel defeats. And they said, we want to fight. Israel said, we don't really want to. And they said, well, we're going to. So Israel fights them, right? And these are the big, strong, tough guys. Israel takes their the plunders, their land, if you will, doesn't take the land, but takes the bounty, the spoils of victory, if you will. And these people are wigging out. And for 40 years, you kind of get the idea that they have heard about these people wandering the wilderness, and they are terrified, not of them, but what their God has done on their behalf. Okay, verse 11, this is a great picture. Listen to this. How about that? This is a woman confessing what the Israelite God has done. Literally, this is in some ways like taking candy from a baby. Like, we're laying down before you. Like, we are terrified, okay? And listen to this. He is God of heaven above and earth beneath. Like, he is God. Now, again, this is a Canaanite prostitute who does not worship. Obviously, the God of Israel worships other gods, and she is confessing Israel's God as the God. So this is a... this is a conversion statement. She is saying, I believe in your God. Based on the evidence that I have seen and him moving and the stories that I've been told, he's God. My gods are not gods. Okay, verse 12 now. She's going to make a request to these spies.
Now then, please swear to me by the Lord that as I have dealt kindly with you, you also will deal kindly with my father's house. And give me a sure sign.
Okay, I'm sorry. As you have given me hesed, as you have given me loving kindness, just as I have given to you, by the way, I want you to deal with me in the same way. And here's her request. Keep rolling.
That you will save alive my father and mother, my brothers and sisters, and all who belong to them, and deliver our lives from death.
So what is she asking?
Don't kill us.
Don't kill us. Please protect me. Not just me, but my entire family. Will my obedience, my respect and love for your God... I'm asking that to transfer not just to me, but my entire family. Spare all of us. 14, so the men said to her, our life for yours. If you do not tell this business of ours, then it shall come about when the Lord gives us the land that we will deal kindly and faithfully with you. So what is the promise of the spies? Absolutely. You'll live, and by the way, the rest of your whole family. She lets them down in verse 15 by a rope. She sends them away, and I'll show you that in a second. But there is an external sign that she's going to be required to display, to show her obedience and to show her loyalty. Verse 17 and 18. All right, so what's the synopsis of this? What is she saying? Or what are they saying to her?
Anybody in the house is safe. They walk out.
Okay, if you tie the scarlet cord out your window so that we can see it as we come in, knowing that they're there, that's where you are. And it's, in a sense, kind of a public statement of her faith, right? There's a cool kind of backstory if you look at Rahab of, like, the steps of that someone walks through with conversion. There's a statement of heart change, and that heart change, as you see who God is, results in a conversion experience where you literally say with your mouth or in your heart, that is God, he is Lord, I am not, right? And then as you continue to walk through it, a believer today goes through the waters of baptism to identify themselves with that God. She, in a sense, is having to identify herself not with the Canaanite city of Jericho and the gods there within, but with the Lord God. And that red scarlet thread or whatever she was hanging out the window would have been evidence of her conversion, if you will. So I don't know that Joshua wrote this so that we would understand a conversion experience, but it is fascinating to see the parallels, okay? So as you look at the map here, Plains of Moab, right over here, this is where Israel's camp. You've got the Dead Sea right here. They cross the Jordan to go in to spy out the land. They're going to camp ultimately at Gilgal. So this is going to be, can you guys see that? Israel's kind of base camp as they start doing business in the land. Jericho is this first city that they're going to fight. Now, she says in verse... where is it? She sends them out and tells them where to go. Into the hill country. Where is that verse?
16.
Thank you. Read that.
16. Now she said unto them, go to the hills, for the pursuers will not find you. Hide yourselves there 3 days until they return, and then go on.
Perfect. So where's the hill country, by the way? West. Where is their base? East. So where does she send them? The opposite direction of where you would be looking. So they head west up into the hill country, right? This is the hilly area towards Jerusalem and such. This is the mountains of Judah over here. And then the Jericho squadron or whatever they send out is going to go east, thinking that's where they would return from. They stay there 3 days. They're not found out, and then ultimately return back to their camp to give the report of what they had dealt with Rahab in following. Okay, so that's the idea. So she protects them, saves their life. And in return for doing that, they have now promised and covenanted with her that they will spare her life and her whole family's if they will demonstrate their faith by external obedience, if you will. Okay, verse 23, the two men returned, came down from the hill country, crossed over the Jordan to Joshua the son of Nun, related to him all that had happened, and they said to Joshua, surely the Lord has given all the land into our hands. Moreover, the inhabitants of the land have melted away before us. Now, what was the report of 12 spies who, by the way, saw the exact same thing 40 years ago? They saw the same thing that these spies saw. How did these new spies see it, if you will? What's the difference? Yeah, and what is Jericho? Fortified city with a ton of people, with walls and gates. It's the same thing. What's the difference in the report? Their faith, right? They see God has given us this land. Has anything changed? No. Like, it's the same situation that we had 40 years ago. The people didn't miraculously get smaller. The fortified cities go away, right? It's not anything different, but our faith says that, man, God has given us this land, and we heard from Rahab what they have heard about our God as we've been rolling through the land and these sorts of things. So they are, their perspective is what Joshua had hoped for. Okay, so they get back and bring back a great report. Okay, so now God is going to begin to move them forward. Chapter 3, verse 1, we're going to see now them leave Gilgal and begin to head across the Jordan and make preparations for that. 3, verse 1, let's pick up there. All right, so they are on the east side of the Jordan right before they're about to cross, and now he's going to give some commands.
At the end of the 3 days, officers went through the camp and commanded the people, as soon as you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God being carried by the Levitical priests, then you shall set out from your place and follow it.
All right, so who's going first?
The
Ark of God carried by the priests, right? Exactly the way God said to carry it. And notice how far in front of them they are. Verse 4. 2,000 cubits, okay, which is about a half mile. So you're sending, you know, the white bathrobe-wearing, non-fighting dudes with a large wooden box a half a mile in front of everybody, completely unprotected, right, to go into battle, right? And everyone that's going to fight is a half mile behind you. These guys are sitting ducks. This is dumb if you're not God, right? But you are God, or we have a God that is the God, so we're going to follow him. But that, militarily, this is dumb, right? And if you're the priest, you're thinking, boy, God better show up today because everyone that can fight is behind me. I'm carrying this really heavy box, right? I can do nothing. So Levi goes first. Joshua says in verse 5, then consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do wonders among you. What does it mean to consecrate yourselves? We've seen that terminology before, specifically in Leviticus. What is Joshua, the military commander, saying to the people? Get your hearts ready. Consecrate yourselves, right? We would see Moses go up the hill to get the Ten Commandments, and they go back down and say, hey, for 3 days, sit here. Get ready. Get your hearts right. This is a big deal. Consecrate yourselves. When the Levites launched into the priesthood in chapters 8 through 10 of Leviticus, we see God say to them, consecrate yourselves. Have a quiet time, right? Spend time with me. Think about and meditate on me. Joshua, the military commander, is doing what? The exact same thing. This isn't about me giving you plans of battle. And, let me show you how to swing a sword and how to whack somebody with a plowshare or whatever. He's saying, no, get your hearts right. Walk with God. Isn't that great? What did God tell him in chapter 1? Be strong and courageous. Hide this book of the law in your heart. Obey it. And that's what he's telling the people. This is all we have to do. It's very simple. It's scary because you're not teaching people how to fight. You're teaching people how to pray, right? Essentially. And that's Joshua's strategy. They're not warriors. They're obedient Jews. And that's what they do. Joshua says in verse 6, take up the Ark of the Covenant, cross over the Jordan. So they cross over. So they took in verse 6 the Ark ahead of the people. Joshua says in verse 7, this day shall begin to exalt you. And the Lord said to Joshua, this day I will begin to exalt you in the sight of all of Israel, that they may know that just as I have been with Moses, I will be with you. This is fascinating. God says to make sure the people will trust you so they can see an external sign that you are indeed my chosen leader, right? That Moses handed the baton to you. I'm going to do something miraculous, okay? Look at verse 9 and following. Pick up there.
And Joshua said to the people of Israel, come here and listen to the words of the Lord your God. And Joshua said, here is how you shall know that the living God is among you, and that he will, without fail, drive out from before you the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Hivites, the Perizzites, the
Girgashites, Amorites, Jebusites, all the Ites, all our favorites. How are they going to know? Keep going.
Behold, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of all the earth is passing over before you into the Jordan. Now therefore take 12 men from the tribes of Israel, from each tribe of man, and when the soles of the feet of the priests bearing the Ark of the Lord of all the earth shall rest in the waters of the Jordan. The waters of the Jordan shall be cut off from flowing, and the waters coming down from above shall stand in one heap.
So what is the sign externally that God is indeed blessing Joshua and the people? We're going to shut down the waters of the Jordan. As far as Adam, not on this map. Not on that map. Yep. Okay. Adam is, it's mentioned in here. Dang it. I thought it was on one of my maps I was showing you guys this morning. Booger, I really thought it was that one. There it is. Sorry. Adam, okay. So the Jordan River's here. God's going to shut down the waters at Adam, and from here down, there will be no flow. Okay, by the way, when are they entering in the land? What season is it? Anybody know? It's spring. It's the harvest season, okay? It's the rainy season. So if you're going to cross a river, when would you not do it? In the rainy season, right? When it's flooding its banks, or we're going to see the condition of the river. God's like, no, that's actually when I like to do things, when the deck is stacked against me, and I've got to show who I am. So the rivers stop literally at Adam all the way down to where they're crossing, and God's going to show them just like he did with Moses in the Red Sea. They're going to cross on dry land. As soon as the priest's feet hit the waters will stop. There's some preaching done. Jordan River means like to descend or to go down. Some have said it means judgment. So the waters of judgment go from, they stop at Adam. Verse 16, this is obviously some very English preaching that's been done here as opposed to Jewish. All the way down to Zarethan. So from A to Z, the waters of judgment stop. People cross through the waters of judgment without being judged, if you will. So there's some symbolism there of maybe a picture of the completeness of God shutting down what should have been judgment for the people, allowing them to pass through judgment safely because of his provision, yada, yada, yada. So,
just kind of curious with, like, God speaking to Moses and then God speaking to Joshua, is there anything in like the translation or kind of like, because it, like, did God just speak the same way that he did to Moses to Joshua, or is there a difference because they keep on putting Moses at such a high regard of like seeing the face and walking with God at the same time?
It seems like it's similar in that he speaks directly with him, but there's something about the nature of how God spoke with Moses that was unique. That face-to-face idea, Joshua doesn't have that. So there's something that's unique, but we don't see necessarily in the language of the text that would highlight that, other than what God said as to how he dealt with Moses. He spoke to Moses and Miriam, Aaron and Miriam, about, don't you know that this is my prophet? I speak to him face to face like no man ever before me or afterwards, so not just through dreams. So maybe this is, some of it may be dreams, some of it may be audible or however he heard him, but it's somehow different than Moses to some degree. Okay, so that's a great question. I don't honestly know the details of how that happened, if it was always dreams or other things, but there you go. Okay, so that is the promise. That is what God says. Okay, you're going to know that I am indeed with you. I'm going to shut down the waters at flood stage. Verse 15, you see it. For the Jordan overflows its banks all the days of harvest. Okay, it's Passover season. We're in April-ish. Verse 17, you're going to cross on dry ground, and the entire nation is going to walk across the Jordan. In one day, we're going to get 2 to 3 million people across the Jordan. Okay, now, before they do that, Joshua is going to do something that's brilliant. He's going to make sure that this event is remembered, right? Moses had the Song of Moses in chapter 15 of Exodus. After they crossed the Red Sea, they wrote a song about it, right? Joshua is going to do something different, but he's going to make sure the people understand the significance of this event, okay? 4 verse 1, let's pick up there. All right, so in verse 3, they've crossed the Jordan, and God says to Moses, or to Joshua rather, get rocks from your campground. Take them from the west side of the Jordan, one for every tribe. So you got 12 rocks, or 13 if the Israelites or the Levites did it as well, and take them with you, okay? Joshua calls them in verse 4, says, do that. Verse 5, cross again to the ark of the Lord your God in the middle of the Jordan, and each of you take your stone on his shoulder according to the number of tribes in Israel, and let this, in verse 6, be a sign among you, so that when your children ask later, what do these 12 stones mean, that you shall say to them, in verse 7, because the waters of the Jordan were cut off before the ark of the covenant of the Lord, when we crossed the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan were cut off, so these stones shall become a memorial to the sons of Israel forever. So they take 12 stones that were outside the Jordan, put them in the Jordan, and then in verse 9, Joshua set up 12 stones in the middle of the Jordan in the place where the feet of the priests who would carry the ark of the Lord, and then they take rocks from the Jordan River out of the river and make it a monument outside the river. So there's this really cool exchange of rocks, right? Rocks that were not supposed to be judged got judged, if you will. Rocks that were judged didn't get judged and got to come out, okay? So there's this picture, if you will, of the waters of judgment or the waters of descent. There's a swap that takes place, like a substitution, if you will. And what was that rock pile that ultimately is outside the Jordan River? What does Joshua say its purpose is?
Memorial.
Yeah, it's a Sunday school lesson. Hey, Dad, what do those rocks mean, okay? It was a launching point for the husband or the family to say, oh, yeah. Let me tell you about what God did this day. And it was insane. So every time they would see it, there would literally be a visual memorial to what God did. Okay, we went to Israel. One of my first years I went. And we'll always grab rocks, right, to symbolize stuff. And I'll write down whatever city I was in because they're free, right? And I can make a rock, whatever. There was a gal, when she came home, she made a rock garden. And in her garden, amongst like all of the stuff that she had, she literally labeled rocks, and each one had a name of a city on it. Like, this is Azekah, this is Lachish, this is Beth Shemesh, this is whatever. And it allowed her to walk through her garden and to remember the stories and the lessons that were there. And then when she walked other people through her garden, she would talk about, what does Azekah mean? Oh, Azekah is where David fought Goliath, and here's how God showed up that day. And it literally was a very simple but really cool memorial of God's faithfulness in her life and the stories and the lessons that she had taken with her from Israel. God is having Israel do that as well. You're going to remember this event. I don't want you to forget it. And a generation later, for the kids that didn't get to cross the Jordan, they were maybe in mama's tummy or weren't even around yet, they're not going to know of God's faithfulness, by the way, Deuteronomy 6, unless you parents tell them of me and what I have done. So that is the picture that Joshua is trying to communicate to this group of people, okay? By the way, this generation, right? What is the condition of their hearts overall, this new generation that's going into the land? They're good people, right? They love God, right? That's why they're going in. Their parents, not so much. They're all dead in the wilderness, right? What happens to the next generation? See also the book of Judges. What's the problem with them? They're facing the toilet, right? What did the current generation fail to do to the up-and-coming generation? They didn't train them. They didn't talk about the stories. They did not pass on their faith, if you will, to the up-and-coming generation. And that was part of the issue as to why we end up where we do in the book of Judges, where it's like ollie-ollie oxen free and everybody will do whatever you want to do. Do whatever's right in your own eyes, as we'll see as the theme of Judges. And it goes crazy. Okay, but Joshua is trying to make sure that this generation is instilling godliness in the next generation. And that is the parents' job to do that, okay? So those are the 12 stones. Verse 12, look who crosses over, just as they said they would. So they come, 40,000 people, and how do they come? They come in battle array. They're ready to do business. They are not messing around. So they have given that promise. They're keeping that promise. They're not coming to watch the game and sit on the, you know, the couch and see everybody else fight. No, they've come to fight, okay? On that day, verse 14, the Lord exalted Joshua in the sight of all of Israel so that they revered him, just as they revered Moses all the days of his life. God does Joshua right here, does him a solid, if you will, by showing the people, this is my God, I am working through him just like I worked through Moses. He's not the same dude, but this is my guy, obey him. So God does a great thing so that the people can see the obedience of Joshua and God's hand upon him, okay? Notice in verse 19, the people came up from the Jordan on the 10th day of the first month. Anybody remember the significance of the 10th day of the first month? We talked about it in Leviticus. It's Lamb Selection Day. It's 5 days before Passover, 4 days before Passover, right? The 14th of the month is Passover. So they cross the Jordan, come out of the Jordan on Lamb Selection Day, exactly 40 years after God had released them from Egypt, okay? Those 12 stones they put in there, they set up this monument, and we're going to find out they're going to celebrate Passover here in a couple days, okay? Now, chapter 5, here's the chapter that makes absolutely no sense. This is crazy. 5 verse 1.
As soon as all the kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan to the west and all the kings of the Canaanites who were by the sea heard that the Lord had dried up the waters of the Jordan for the people of Israel until they had crossed over, their hearts melted, and there was no longer any spirit in them because of the people of Israel.
All right, so Israel's now on the west side of the Jordan. Okay, they don't have the protection of the Jordan River anymore between them and their enemies. They're in their enemies' land. And what is the condition of their enemies? Oh, don't hurt us, right? They're all freaking out. Their hearts are melted before them, okay? So they are like, this is like ripe for the pickings. Like, you can just walk through and say, okay, give me that. Okay, give me that. Okay, leave. Okay, see you later. I'm going to go ahead and take this. That's the idea.
I was just kind of, I mean, the map kind of makes it seem like it's a long distance, but I was kind of trying to figure out the distance between the river and Jericho, and it's like less than 5 miles.
Yeah, it's short. Yeah,
so
thank you.
So I feel like they could have probably seen 2 to 3 million people coming up.
For sure. You remember when we drove that road north? We were leaving the day we did... it was like Masada and Gedi Qumran. And we drove north out of there. You can see the Jordan River on your right, which, by the way, is like the Jordan Brook now. It's not like, it's very disappointing, unfortunately, but with water rights and whatever, the flow's really, it's like rivers here in California. In Fresno, you're like, oh, that's supposed to be a river. It looks like a big dry creek bed, because it is. But to your left, you can look and see Jericho. It's just kind of right up the hill. And we don't go there because there's not a lot to see anymore, but it's right there. So they totally would have seen it, right? They would have watched these people cross, and they're sitting literally at their doorstep, and everyone in Jericho is wigging out. Okay, that is the Hebrew. And this is Joshua's idea from God in verse 2. Tell me if this doesn't make a ton of sense.
At that time, the Lord said to Joshua, make flint knives and circumcise the sons of Israel the second time.
Okay, there's a whole lot of odd stuff in here. So number one, what are we going to do to all the men? All the men that are able to fight, what are we going to do? Yes, we're going to have them laid out on a cot for 3 days, right? You're getting circumcised. That's not something that you don't go fight after lunch, right? You get circumcised in the morning. You're like, okay, it's all good, right? So that's odd. And then it says we're going to circumcise them a second time. Like, there's an explanation for that. It doesn't really mean a second time. It means the first generation was circumcised, right? They had to get circumcised. The new generation had not yet been circumcised. So they had walked through this 40-year journey in the wilderness and had never been circumcised. So Joshua says, why not today? This is a great day to do it. We've crossed over. Our enemies are right there. They all have instruments of warfare. Let's all get circumcised. Dumb. This doesn't make any sense. Okay, so Joshua made himself a flint knife, and he circumcised the sons of Israel at Gibeoth Haraloth. Okay, Haraloth, or however you say that, right? That's a cool name. This just does not make any sense. What is God doing with the people right now? Why would he do this? Absolutely. Some of it's that. What is he doing within the Israelites? Yeah. Do you believe that I'm in charge of these battles? Do you really trust me? Ladies, when your husband's down and he can't fight, and the only, adult left in your camp that is mobile is you, and you're protecting your kids, do you trust me? Do you trust that I'll provide for you? Your enemy is right there in that gigantic fortified city, at least in your eyes. Do you trust that I'll take care of this, right? It doesn't make sense, but this is what God has him do. And what does Joshua do? Okay, let's do it. So everybody get in line. Like, that had to be a fun conversation. Okay, here's what we're going to do today, guys. Everybody's getting circumcised. So verse 4, this is the reason why Joshua circumcised them. And he tells you in verse 4 and 5, no one had been circumcised yet, okay, after they left Egypt, this group of people. So again, if obedience is the key to victory, then you don't get to skip out on this. Now, I would have said, hey, how about we do it on the other side of the Jordan? Or, hey, by the way, we had 40 years to take care of this and we're bored out of our minds. Why not then? But God says, no, now. We're all going to get circumcised. So sons of Israel walked in 40 years. Verse 6, God is faithful to them, does not let their sandals wear out. All these things, the generation before them in verse 6 died because of disobedience, but God now circumcises them. And in verse 9, you get a picture of what this means.
The Lord said to Joshua, this day I have rolled away the reproach of Egypt from you. Therefore, the name of the place shall be called Gilgal to this day.
Okay, Gilgal means to roll or rolling. So he's rolled away the reproach of Egypt, meaning you have separated yourselves from Egypt. You are circumcised. You have identified yourself with me as your God, and I've taken away that reproach. Yeah, Jacob.
Why wouldn't they have circumcised him in the wilderness?
I have no idea.
I mean, wasn't that a command in the law?
Yep.
On the eighth day?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I don't know if it was a logistics thing or God just didn't. Obviously, God is waiting to this point to do it. There's some type of reproach that's seen on them because they haven't done that. I don't know that it was a heart thing. It was just, I don't know, maybe a logistics deal. I don't know. But, boy, obviously they get a whole bunch of people circumcised in a day. So, again, that's, it's odd. But this is the time that God calls for it. And logistically, it makes no sense. But heart-wise and trust-wise, it makes a ton of sense. So God is making sure that this generation believes, you better trust me because you are sitting ducks right now. Literally, they are a turtle on their back right now. If Jericho, all they had to do was come down and fight what was left of the women and children, and Israel would be wiped out forever, gone. But they don't, because God had done what to Jericho? They're all in Jericho doing what? Crying and sucking their thumbs, right? We're all going to die, you know. They're wigging out, and that's what God is. It's just this beautiful story of God's sovereign hand on all of this. Really cool, okay? Now, watch what else stops. Actually, before that, verse 10. Now it's 3 days later, right? They're recovering from circumcision. While the sons of Israel, in verse 10, camped at Gilgal, they observed Passover on the evening of the 14th day. So not only do they get circumcised, but now what do they stop to do? Set up the tabernacle. Let's bring all the sheep and the goats and whatever to the priest. Let's eat. Let's have this gigantic buffet. Let's have a six-hour dinner. They celebrate Passover, right? And all of Jericho is watching this right down the hill, right? Crazy. Verse 12, watch what stops.
And the manna ceased the day after they ate of the produce of the land, and there was no longer manna for the people of Israel, but they ate of the fruit of the land of Canaan that year.
How cool is that? So God says, hey, there's going to be a day you're going to cross over, and you're going to eat grapes that you didn't take care of, you didn't water them, you didn't, you know, prune the vines. You're going to get to eat the bounty of the land, and the manna's going to stop. And literally, the day after Passover, it looks like, they eat from the bounty of the land, and they enjoy its provisions. Just as God says, I provided for you this way in this season, in the season to come, I'm going to provide for you, but it's going to look different. It's not going to be the same. So, that's the picture. Now, in 13 and 15, there's an interaction that now Joshua's going to have with a guy that is pretty cool. Okay, you guys have probably all heard about this at some point in your Sunday school lessons, for those of you that donned the doors of church early on. 13, pick up there.
When Joshua was by Jericho, he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, a man was standing before him with his drawn sword in his hand. And Joshua went to him and said to him, are you for us or for our adversaries?
So what's Joshua doing? Joshua was by Jericho. What's he doing? Probably scouting a little bit. Maybe he's praying. Maybe he's asking God for favor, right? He's looking around, and he sees a dude with a sword in his hand. And what is Joshua's response? Whose team are you on? Like, what? Are you beginning to see Joshua's personality? Like, he's probably going, what team are you on? You know, like, you kind of get the idea that this guy's, he's ready to battle. Like, are you on my team or not on my team? Because if we're going to fight, let's go. So he's got that kind of bulldog mentality, ears pinned back. He's ready to go. And here's the answer that he gets.
And he said, no, but I am the commander of the army of the Lord. Now I have come.
So what's the answer that he gets? No. I didn't come to take sides, as Tony Evans says in his church back in Dallas. He says, man, I didn't come to take sides. I came to take over. I'm in charge. I'm the guy. I am the captain of the Lord of hosts. Who is this dude? It's the angel of the Lord. It's the same angel of the Lord that wrestled with Jacob, that we've seen in our the pre-incarnate Christ. He now appears to Joshua and says, I am the guy. I am in charge. And what is Joshua's response?
And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and worshipped and said to him, what does my Lord say to his servant?
Wow. Like, Joshua goes, Roger, got that, okay, on my face. He worships this man, right? Now, it's a fascinating picture when we see this guy. Are we to worship angels? No, and angels are clear about that. We see that in Scripture where men try to do that, and they refuse worship. Does this guy refuse Joshua's worship? No. Joshua calls him Lord. And he says, the captain of the Lord's host in verse 15 says, remove your sandals from your feet, for the place where you are standing is holy. The battle that's about to take place here is sanctified. God is up to something. I am here to lead the charge. I'm the guy, right? And Joshua responds in obedience. So there's this cool picture of who's ultimately in charge in the midst of this. Yeah, Stephen. There will be a day, right? That's Revelation 19, when Christ comes back with a sword, a cleaver, and is going to do battle. So yes, one day. I think this is more of a picture of God's saying, I'm leading them. As a military commander, I'm leading you. So I don't think he does the battle per se. He's not swinging the sword. But that is, I think it's a picture to remind them of a facet, a characteristic of God that is able to do even this. I'm not just the God that fed you in the wilderness. I'm the God that's going to go to battle before you. So.
We do see stories, though, right? In like Isaiah, where like the king prays and then the angel of the Lord just strike down like all the people. And
yeah.
They like wake up in the morning and.
Yeah. 185,000 Assyrians die overnight. So yeah, and it does say it was the angel of the Lord that caused that. So for sure, yeah, there's some good examples of that. Now, what method they use, I don't know, but yeah, God takes down an entire nation by himself while Israel and them are asleep. Okay, so we do see that. Okay, so you're getting the idea again that this is about obedience. This is God's battle. This is not your battle. Logistically, what we're asking you to do doesn't make sense. But how do the people respond, by the way? How do the Israelites respond to this crazy nut brain idea? Yeah, okay, let's get circumcised then. Okay, so you're seeing the faith of this generation, I think, come out, their obedience, if you will. And now in chapter 6, we're going to start the actual battle. We're going to go into Jericho, the first city that Israel is now called to do battle against. 6 verse 1, let's pick up there.
Now Jericho was shut up inside and outside because of the people of Israel. None went out and none came in.
All right, so they're preparing for battle. The drawbridge is closed, if you will. They are ready to fight.
The Lord said to Joshua, "See, I have given Jericho into your hand with its king and mighty men of valor. You shall march around the city, all the men of war going around the city once. Thus shall you do for 6 days."
All right, so here's God's brilliant battle plan. Day one, you're going to go to the city, you're going to march around it, and then what are you going to do? Go home. Go back to Gilgal and camp. Day two, you're going to go to the city, you're going to march around it, and then what? Go home. For 6 days, you're going to do this. And he's going to tell him, you are going to march in utter silence. You will not say a word. Now, you talk about psychological warfare. If you're Jericho and you see now all these men coming at you, literally hundreds of thousands of men coming at you in whatever battle array that they had at that point, and they're silent and they're marching around the city, that had to be a very creepy, eerie feeling. Like, no shots are fired, no arrows are going off, they're going to watch, right? And they would watch day one, probably in some sort of awe and silence, and then they would walk home and do nothing. How are you feeling if you're in Jericho at that point? Pretty good, right? They left, you're probably freaking out, but then they came and then they did what? They went home. And then they come do this, the same thing the next day. How are you feeling now in Jericho? Like, is that all you got? Or are you probably talking some smack, right? You can imagine the insults in day 3 and 4, as this was the pattern and Israel was doing nothing. They were probably being hurled at them, hurled at their God. You know, there's probably guys on top mooning people. I don't know, right? Whatever Canaanites do to Israelite warriors, they were doing. They were probably scared at first, but as Israel did nothing and their God was doing nothing, the favor and the confidence probably began to shift. And then on the 7th day, God says it's going to change, okay? Let's see. Let's keep going to verse 4. This is a really cool picture, by the way.
7 priests shall bear 7 trumpets of ram's horns before the ark. On the 7th day, you shall march around the city 7 times, and the priests shall blow the trumpets.
Okay, now, so 7th day, you do 7 laps. We've done now 13 laps total. First 6 days, 1. The last day, 7. So 13 total. And then he says, you're going to have the priests, and they're going to blow 7 trumpets. 7, literally a ram's horn, right? That was their trumpet. Why would they blow a ram's horn? What is the significance of that? Turn real quick to your left. Go back to Leviticus and see if this maybe puts this in context. Leviticus chapter 25. Concerning the law of the year of Jubilee, okay? 25:8. You also are to count off 7 Sabbaths of years. That's 49 years, 70 times 7, or 7 times 7, so that you will have the time of 70 Sabbaths of years, namely 49 years, or 50 years. So every 50 years, this was the command in Israel. You shall then sound a ram's horn abroad on the 10th of the 7th month, on the Day of Atonement. you shall sound a horn all throughout the land. So on the Day of Atonement, a horn is sound every 50 years. You shall thus consecrate the 50th year and proclaim a release of the land to all of its inhabitants. In the year of Jubilee for you, each of you shall return to his own property and to each of you to his own family. What is the significance? What happens on the year of Jubilee? Any property that had been acquired in trades or marriages went to where? Back to its original owner. Why is God blowing a trumpet when they walk into Jericho? What is happening to the land? It's going back to its original owner, God. So God is saying, this is my land. Okay? That's the picture of the ram's horn, why they are blowing that. This is God's land, and I am giving it to my people because I am able. So in verse 4 of chapter 6, they blow the ram's horn. They march around the city. Verse 7 now, he's going to say, take the Ark of the Covenant, verse 6, march around the city 6 times, priests lead us again. Verse 10, notice how they're to march. This is where it's mentioned.
Joshua commanded the people, you shall not shout or make your voice heard, neither shall any word go out of your mouth until the day I tell you to shout. Then you shall shout.
Yeah, and then you're going to wig out, right? I'm going to tell you to shout, and you're going to get your shout on, okay? Verse 13, the priest carrying the 7 trumpets of the ram's horn before the ark of the Lord went up continually, blew the trumpets, the armed men before them, and the rear guard, the ark of the Lord, they continued to blow the trumpets. The second day they did the same thing. And then in verse 15, watch this.
But it came to pass on the 7th day that they rose early about the dawning of the day, and they marched around the city 7 times in the same manner. On that day only they marched around the city 7 times. And the 7th time that it happened, when the priest blew the trumpets, Joshua said to the people, shout, for the Lord has given you the city.
All right, so God's now going to deliver the city, and here's how he's going to do it.
Now the city shall be doomed by, or shall be doomed by the Lord to destruction. It and all that are all who are in it. Only Rahab the harlot who shall live. She and all who are with her in the house, because she hid the messengers he sent.
Okay, so we remember obviously Rahab. So God's going to be faithful to his promise. My version says the city shall be under the ban. What does under the ban mean? See also verse 18. Verse 18. Keep yourselves from things under the ban so that you do not covet them, and take some of the things under the ban and make the camp of Israel accursed and bring trouble on it. What does it mean regarding this city and how Israel is to deal with it? You're going to destroy everything. You don't get to take any of the spoils of victory. Okay, so that sweet coat, those sweet pair of Nike kicks, that nice Calphalon pan, none of it. Everything gets burned. Okay, and this is a hard city. Verse 21, they utterly destroyed everything in the city, man, woman, young and old, ox, sheep, donkey, with the edge of the sword. This again is rare. You do not see this as God's normative action as they go through the 31 battles. Jericho is an exception to how God does battle. But he says, everything is under the ban. Everything will be sacrificed to me. Okay? 20, by the way, they blow the trumpets. And how does, I mean, you guys know the story. How does Jericho won as a city? What happens to the walls? They all just fall down in verse 20, right? The walls fall down flat. So the people went up out of the city in verse 20. Every man straight ahead, and they took the city. So literally, after the 7th time they march around, on the 7th day, all the walls fall flat, and they just walk into the city and take everything, okay? And they devote everything to destruction. God says, do not take a thing. Just remember Rahab, 24, the city. They burned the city with fire and all that was in it. Only the silver and gold and articles of bronze and iron they put into the treasury of the house of the Lord. So they tithe, if you will, this first city to God. This is God's, and as a symbolic action of God's victory, they give all of the spoils of victory to God. City was burned. Verse 25, Rahab the harlot, her father's household, and all she had, Joshua spared. So they save Rahab. They make that promise. So even though the city was under the ban and totally devoted to destruction, the word of the spies was upheld. They are saved. 26, watch what Joshua says now in regards to this city.
Then Joshua Joshua charged them at the time, saying, "Cursed be the man before the Lord who rises up and builds this city Jericho. He shall lay its foundation with the firstborn, with his youngest he shall set up its gates." So the Lord was with Joshua, and his fame spread throughout the country.
So what is the curse of Jericho? Don't rebuild on it. And what happens if you try to rebuild Jericho? You're going to lose your kids, okay? 1 Kings chapter 16 tells of the story of a guy by the name of Hillel, who was Ahab's chief builder. And he loses two of his kids. He's the first guy that has the idea, maybe we should rebuild Jericho. Ahab is one of Israel's most wicked kings. He says, we're going to rebuild here, forgets the law of God. And Hillel, his builder, loses two male sons building this city, just as Joshua said. And by the way, hundreds and hundreds of years after this is issued. Okay, so God says, don't do it. It's mine. Okay? So battle one, we're 1-0. Okay? Crazy battle. This is how God decides to win this. Now Joshua's fame is beginning to spread, and we're going to see how he handles this success, if you will. 7 verse 1. All right, so behind the scenes, this is what's happened. Joshua is unaware of it. This dude named Achan, Achan, took some of the things from under the ban, and how does God feel about that? The anger of the Lord burns. Okay, that's not good. Okay, so yours says, Haley, what version are you reading from?
ESV.
ESV, they nailed it, okay? The sons of Israel acted, mine says, unfaithfully, literally broke faith, okay? They did not have faith, and they broke what God said to do. So God says the whole city's under the ban, take nothing. What does Achan decide he's going to do? I'm kind of the exception. I'm going to take what I want, okay? Joshua, verse 2, watch what he does. Sends men now to Jericho, from Jericho to Ai, the next city over. Here's Ai, okay? This is the next battle that they've got to go fight. Again, not that far. We're talking about, you know, this is just a 5-mile journey. Is that what we talked about, Josue? From the river to Jericho. So that's maybe a little bit more than that, up against some wadis. So a climb up to there, but Ai is not far away. Okay. So Joshua now says, I'm going to send men to Ai near Beth-Aven, near Bethel, in verse 2. It says, go spy out the land. The men spied out the land. Verse 3, they return to Joshua. And what do they say in verse 3? Right? So how many people did Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh have to go do battle? 40,000. So they send like less than a tribe. Just send like 3,000 people. A couple thousand really is all we need. 2,000 or 3,000 at most. Don't toil with the people. It's really small. How are they feeling right now? We got this, right? Huge battle. Why would Joshua send spies again? Did it work last time? You know, this is how God works. I shake the magic eight ball. This is what happens. Does he pray? Does he ask God, Lord, how do you want me to take Ai? There's none of that. You see some arrogance, if you will, in Joshua, some lack of, like, connecting with God. Okay, so they do that. Verse 4, they sent 3,000 people, but, end of verse 4, they fled from the men of Ai. Verse 5, the men struck down 36 men. So 36 Israelites die. And they pursue them as far back as Sherebarim, okay, and struck them down. The people come back into town with their tails between their legs, thinking they were just going to roll these people. And the opposite happens. They get steamrolled, and God is gracious. They only lose 36 people, and now their hearts are melted, and they don't understand why. Joshua, in verse 6, is wigging out. And he goes to God and says, hey, what the heck? Verse 7, O Lord God, why did you ever bring this people over the Jordan, only to deliver us into the hand of the Amorites to destroy us? If we had only been willing to stay on the other side of the Jordan, on the east side, in the not our land, right? Verse 8, O Lord, what can I say, since Israel has turned their backs before their enemies? The Canaanites and all the inhabitants of the land will hear of it. They will surround us and cut off our name from the earth. And what will you do for your great name? Joshua doesn't understand what happened, right? What's the key to victory? Obedience. And Joshua just lost a battle. So what should Joshua be going, what should be going off in his head? Somewhere there's been disobedience, right? This isn't a battle strategy. This isn't God overslept and forgot to win the battle at Ai. Something should be happening. And he's praying to God, and I love God's response in verse 10. There are times to pray, and by the way, there are times not to pray. This is a not pray time. This is what God says to him.
So the Lord said to Joshua, get up. Why do you lie thus on your face?
What does that mean? Get up. Why are you lying on your face? What is he saying to Joshua? He's confessing, he's repenting, he's praying, he's talking to God, and God's saying, this is not the time for that. Get up. Why?
Joshua already knows.
He should already know, but he doesn't. And God's saying, you know, at least you should, as the leader of Israel, why you lost that battle. And the synapses are not firing right now. You're not understanding why we lost. And I'm going to have to tell you in verse 11.
Israel has sinned in that, and they have also transgressed my covenant which I commanded them. For they have taken from the accursed things and have both stolen and deceived. They have also put it among their own stuff. Therefore, the children of Israel could not stand before their enemies, but turned their backs before their enemies.
All right, stop right there. So what's happened? Israel sinned, and God says to Joshua, that's what happened, and you should, as a leader, understand that. So Joshua is getting a very humbling lesson in what it means to be both the military and the spiritual leader of Israel. I told you, if you obey, you're going to get blessed, and you will win these battles. If you disobey, you won't. It's as simple as that. So Joshua should have figured this out. Now, notice who God says has sinned. Israel. How many people took stuff under the ban? One dude. By the way, who is Achan? Anybody know who this dude is? We get a description of him. Oh, where is it? He is a leader amongst Israel. Okay, he's not some random guy at the rabble that's come in on the outskirts of the camp. This guy is a leader within Israel, okay? And God is making a statement about, as goes one, so goes all, if you will. So God sees the whole nation as having sinned because one guy is walking in disobedience. At the church I work for in Dallas, right when I got out of seminary, we had a leadership retreat with a bunch of the people in the church, right? And it was, the staff and what have you, and then it was all of the lay leadership. And our pastor taught on this passage, and he talked about how if you want to stop the movement of God in the church, all it takes is one person who is in leadership that's not walking in obedience and humility to God, and God will literally shut down the entire operation to deal with that guy. And you're all like, oh, God, okay, right? What's my sin list? Have I confessed them all? Am I doing okay? You're just thinking like, wow. But the idea that the message was, the weight of responsibility as a leader is significant, and Achan blows it because of his own clear, outright, defiant disobedience. He doesn't listen to God, and he takes everything under the ban, or takes some things under the ban, and we find out what he takes. He takes this in verse 21, a mantle from Shinar, some type of statue from Babylon that apparently these Canaanites had acquired in battle. He takes 200 shekels of silver, a bar of gold worth 50 shekels in weight. So he takes some pretty sweet, loot, if you will, from the battle, okay? And that's ultimately where this goes for Israel. And God now has got to get Israel to the point where they're going to confess, and Joshua is now going to have to figure out, of these 3 million people, who's in sin here? What's going on, okay? 13, God says, consecrate yourselves. Tomorrow we're going to figure out, we're going to find out who's taking the things from under the ban. So this guy won't confess. He doesn't come forward. He doesn't speak to his sins. Verse 14, in the morning, you're going to take each tribe by name, okay? Each big family, and we are going to cast lots by family, okay? So we're going to line up all the tribes, we're going to cast lots and go, okay, other 11 of you, y'all go away. Judah, someone in Judah has sinned. And God's slowly just going to whittle down every person in that process. Verse 16, Joshua rose early in the morning, brought Israel near to the tribes, and the tribe of Judah was taken. So the priest would have rolled the Urim and Thummim and somehow have ascertained who was the tribe that the guilty party was a part of. And it starts with Judah, okay? If you're Achan at this point, and the odds are you're hiding in the midst of 3.2 million people or 3 million people, right? How are you feeling? Are you ever going to find me? Like, no way. And then they roll, and they pick Judah. What tribe are you from, Achan? Judah. Now you're thinking, okay, that's just a coincidence, right? Verse 17, he brought the family of Judah near, and then he took the family, the subfamily of Judah, the Zerarites. Like, oh, wow, that's actually my family, right? Are you seeing God just kind of slowly whittle this down? Achan's probably beginning to wig out. He brought near the family of the Zerarites. He took a man by a man, and Zabdi, who is now Achan's pops, is brought near, takes now his household man by man, and Achan, the son of Carmi, the son of Zabdi, the son of Zerah, from the tribe of Judah was taken. So God whittles it down from millions of people to one dude. And then Joshua and this guy in verse 19 have a conversation. Read that.
Now Joshua said to Achan, my son, I beg you, give glory to the Lord of Israel and make confession to him and tell me now what you have done.
So what is God asking? What is Joshua asking to give glory to the Lord? What does that mean? Confess. What have you done? He says confess. And that brings glory to God when we confess our sins. Achan now in verse 20 says to Joshua, I have sinned against the Lord, the God of Israel. Listen to this process. See if this doesn't sound familiar. 21, when I saw among the spoil of Shinar all these things, then I coveted them, verse 21, and took them. I saw, I coveted, I took. Lust of the eyes, lust of the flesh, the boastful pride of life. What was Eve? I saw the fruit, I coveted it, I took it, and I ate. The exact same process. Has sin changed at all in thousands of years? No. Has it changed for us today? I looked, I saw, wanted something, I coveted it in my heart, I took it for myself. It's the same process that you and I go through every time we choose disobedience instead of walking with God. Okay? Joshua says, man, okay. 22. He sends messengers to this guy's tent. It was concealed underneath it. He dug a hole, put it in the ground. They took from inside the tent in verse 23, brought them to Joshua, all the things that he had confessed. Said and dead, here they are. 24, he took verse 24, and all the sons of Israel took Achan, the son of Zerah, the silver, the mantle, the bar of gold, his sons, his daughters, his oxen, his donkeys, his sheep, his tent, and all that belonged to him, out to the valley of Achor, the valley of trouble. Achan's name, by the way, means what? Trouble. They take him to the valley of Achor, and Joshua said, why have you troubled us? Why have you Achan'd us? Why have you troubled us this day? And Israel stoned them with stones, and they burned them with fire after they had stoned them with stones. How do you feel about that, spiritual leaders of your home? Who else has to pay for dad's sins in this case? Wife, kids, sheep, donkeys, oxen. How does God see that leadership role in the home? In some way, they're all seen as compliant, as complicit in this act. He's probably convinced his family and led them astray where their hearts are now turned. And God takes the lives of this entire family based on the actions of one man. So we don't see what's spoken of the wife and the kids per se, but you kind of get the idea that this man has led them astray and they are held accountable for their actions and their hearts as well. It is a hard, hard day in Israel. And they get stoned. They are killed. There's a heap of stones in verse 26 that is rolled over them. And the Lord turned from the fierceness of his anger. Therefore, the name of the place, end of verse, chapter 7 rather, is the Valley of Achor to this day. Now, here is the incredibly sad thing. Battle number 2 in Ai. You know what God says? Take anything you want. It's all yours. So this guy, because of his greed and because of his lust for stuff, just wouldn't obey God. God doesn't want to be selfish. He's saying, I'm in charge. You're going to tithe to me first. You're going to be the first and the best of your offerings. The rest of the cities, take it all. And this guy, the troubler of Israel, causes great pain on the entire nation and great pain on, obviously, his family as well. And God is serious about his commands. So, fellas, a great reminder to all of us of the spiritual leadership and the task at hand, the weight of that privilege and responsibility, if you will, and how God sees, if you will, a picture of our leadership role and what we can do to a family when we don't choose to walk in obedience.
Is there any indication that him and his family were still saved, even though God had them killed? Because I know, like my wife and I talked about Sapphira and
Ananias and Sapphira.
Ananias and Sapphira, how they, you know, they lied, but or they lied to the Lord, but you know, we don't know if God forgave them and just punished them in front of the people so they would be an example.
Yeah. It's a good question. This is similar to this. This is not always how God acts, whether or not they are saved, and I don't know. I would assume yes, and that they are part of that new generation, and the hearts are right, but boy, he blows it with one action. So it's 7:30. We can stay and ask some questions if you guys want. We need to roll, but we'll pick up here tomorrow, all right? So holler if you got more. I'll stay for a second. You bet. Charge tomorrow. You can email them to me if you want to. They need to be in my inbox by 6 a.m.
So, I think the reason to ask is that no one was right, but I just think it's kind of weird how, like, the 2.5 tribes, like, how that all plays into it. You know, like, they go and they do battle, but then they end up coming back out, you know, like, especially in reference to, like, if it's symbolic of, like, the promise and coming into, like,
Yeah, and I think that was Moses' beef with them originally. He saw it as a violation of, like, what God wanted for them, as opposed to a, they're seeing it as, man, this is just logistics. Like, there's too, we have too much stuff, and we're going to turn into Lot and Abraham, or we're going to crowd each other out, and there's going to be contention. So I think once they convince Moses, no, we're all about the promises of God. We're just asking him to give us, to annex this portion of the land to us as well, so that we can maintain lives and what have you, that it's okay. Now, that is going to cause a division within